Hello, I'm Kimberly Davis, and I am the Fiscal Feminist. Hi, everyone. I'm Kimberly Davis, and I'm the Fiscal Feminist. I'm also a partner and managing director at the Bonson Group, which is a wealth management firm in Newport Beach, California, and also has offices in New York City. So I'm super excited about today because I'm going to be interviewing this very multifaceted lady who has been a TV actress. So she's experienced fame, and she's also currently the CEO of a hybrid publisher called Wonderwell, and her name is Maggie Langerich. Am I saying that right?
You are, yes.
Maggie, welcome. Thank you so much. Maggie has driven from Los Angeles down to Orange County to be with us today, and I really appreciate you making the effort to do that.
No, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And so she's got an amazing, amazing story that I just want to get right into because she is a super good role model for women who are going to make a lot of pivots in their life and, you know, also maybe are experiencing being a single mom. So there's a lot of very interesting topics that we're going to address today. So stay tuned. Listen to the whole thing because you're not going to want to miss 1 minute of this thing. It's going to be awesome. So you have had a very interesting career. And so I went online to figure out what was going on because I know you as a publisher, not as an actress. With full disclosure, Maggie is instrumental in helping me with my book, which I'm currently writing. And just FYI, for anyone out there thinking about writing a book, it's hard. I'm like, wow, this is a big time commitment. And I wasn't quite expecting it to be, you know, because I think I'm such a great writer. And so then I started writing and I was like, oh my God, this is going to be really a big commitment. But Maggie's made it great. And she has been very instrumental in motivating me to do this and helping me with my vision and setting up the whole logistical aspect of writing a book, which is really quite not as simple as one might think. It's not like you just sit down at your laptop and, I mean, maybe you do, but it's really not going to get your book out there to the way, you know, in the way that you might want it to do so. So that's how I know Maggie. It's through the publishing connection. But let's go back to the beginning. And I see that you were an actress and you worked in film and TV. I Googled you. And I saw that you were on some seriously real TV shows.
Yeah, there's even a Wikipedia page for me, which is weird because I didn't create it. And I think that there are some inaccuracies in there and I have no idea how to get them fixed. But it's sort of like, oh, okay, I exist on the internet independent from my own efforts. Weird.
No, it was awesome because I read the Wikipedia page. And anyway, so tell me a little bit about how you decided to get into film and TV acting.
Sure. So, Kim, my story, my life story is a story of someone who allowed the winds of fate to blow her around and had some pretty, you know, pretty decent results from that approach to living. I actually got into acting when I was too young to be making any kinds of decisions for myself anyway. I was 13 years old when I made my first film. And it was.
And was that your decision or your parents' decision?
Well, I suppose it was mine, but my decision, but not my idea or initiative. So here's how what happened. I was. We were friendly with a neighbor who lived across the street from us, and she was a budding independent filmmaker, and she was planning to make a movie about, you know, loosely based on her own sort of adolescence. And she said that she was partly inspired to kind of go for it and write that screenplay through knowing me. I guess I was a precocious, lippy little kid.
No, I don't believe it.
And somehow, you know, she thought, oh, she reminds me of me. And I think that Margaret, as I was known then, would be really great to play me. So she cast me in the leading role.
And geographically, where were you living then?
I was in Vancouver, Canada.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was growing up in Vancouver, Canada. I had actually met Sandy Wilson, the filmmaker, when I think I was 8 or 9 when my family moved in across the street from her. But I was 13 by the time we actually went to camera and shot the film. That that movie was called My American Cousin, and it became a kind of a Western Canadian classic. People, believe it or not, I was, okay, this is a while ago. I am no longer anywhere near 13 years old. I was recognized, I still get recognized in Canada occasionally. I think the last time was, yeah, I was in some sort of like government office applying for some, you know, immigration thing or something. And the person behind the desk, are you the Margaret Langrick?
I'm gonna actually watch this movie.
Oh yeah,
My American Cousin, everyone.
Yeah, yeah, and in fact, the film won a whole bunch of awards. So we have a Canadian kind of version of the Academy Awards. It's called the Genie Awards, and I won the award for Best Actress that year.
Oh my god!
Yeah,
congratulations!
Thank you. So then I, you know, after that, everyone said to me. So it was kind of like it wasn't really like a decision, something that I went for. It was more an opportunity that I said yes to. And that is really something, you know, that dynamic is something that kind of characterized a lot of my life and career, for better or for worse. I was, you know, have been in reactive mode, I suppose, until, I don't know, maybe a decade or 15 years ago when I decided to take my fate in my own hands a bit more. But at that stage, I was really just about saying yes to opportunities. So after the film was made and especially after the award happened, then everyone said to me, you know, like, oh, are you going to keep acting?
So what were you, like 15 at this point?
Yeah, I think I was 15 or I think I was 14 when the film came out, and probably 14 when I won the award too. Still, it was just a year later. Maybe it was 15. Anyway, so at the age of 15, I came down to Hollywood and I made a Universal Pictures film, Harry and the Hendersons, which was a big budget, you know, big budget Hollywood movie shot on the Universal backlot.
So at this stage, you have like an agent, mm-hmm. and they're promoting you out there. So you're a full blown child actor.
Yeah.
At
that point, I was like, really like, okay, this is my thing. I'm just going to do this and I'm going to be serious about it. And it worked out. It worked out great for me for, you know, several years. I think I was in the business for about 10 or 11 years or so, and did a bunch of movies and TV shows before I dropped out to move to England and have a baby.
So do you feel like the working as an actress during, you know, your teen years as a younger person, did it influence maybe how you developed in your mind? I mean, because you weren't going the traditional route. I don't know. How did your schooling get affected by this?
Well, I sort of worked around school, and it's not like I was working all the time flat out. No, I would say that it definitely had an influence on the way that I developed as a person and my attitude toward work. So when you're on a film set, you know, the there's no room for messing around or being flaky or unreliable, like none at all. So even though I was a young teenager, I was, you know, deadly serious about the responsibilities that I had on set. You know, you have to show up. You cannot be sick. You cannot be in a bad mood. You cannot, you know, if you're freezing cold or, you know, you're hungry. I mean, they make you as comfortable as possible, but, you know, there are lots of discomforts and lots of moments where you have to put the production above your own needs or, you know, moods or any of that. So I just learned at a really young age just a rock solid work ethic. And I know that that carried, I don't know whether I would have developed or whether that was inherent in me or something that was cultivated on the film sets over through those years. But I know that by the time I went into like, you know, office life and had a different kind of work, I really brought that with me. So I was always, you know, sort of good foot soldier, eager to please, you know, be humble, show up, do your job. And actually, oddly, that has served me also now as an entrepreneur working for myself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't cut myself any slack, and the work is important and I treat it seriously. So I really do credit my early days on
and
set to that.
Did you have a parent there with you? How were you there kind of at that age doing the work thing by yourself?
It's weird. I'm trying to recall. I did have a parent with me. There are rules about, like, you know, you have to have a guardian on set, but I think with the first film, when I was 13, because the director was a family friend, we sort of made her my de facto guardian. So even though she's like, she had her hands full, but technically she was like looking after me. But what that means is I was pretty independent. And that also is something that has characterized my life. I'm just really, really independent and do my own thing all the time and have been looking out for myself for a long time, since a young age.
But that's good. I mean, if you can handle that responsibility, which I think more people in this world should be going down that path. I think we coddle our kids a lot, me included. I'm not giving myself a free pass on that one. But you didn't have a desire. So you're getting into your early 20s, maybe late, you know, like say 20-ish. You were not compelled to just keep trying to be a movie actress or, you know, get that fame that everyone seems to be searching for.
Well, I did want it a lot. Yeah. So I got round to wanting it. So it fell into my lap, but then it became something that I pursued intentionally. I moved to Los Angeles at the age of 19 without my parents and got an agent here. And I just thought I was going to be like a superstar. Mm-hmm. And in retrospect, I'm glad that I didn't have a gigantic fame experience, because I also now know more about my own psychology and, you know, emotional fragility and various things. I don't think that I would have, I think that there would have been some fallout if that had happened, if I had hit like big money and big note, you know, big noteworthiness, big fame.
Right.
So I'm kind of glad in one sense that that didn't happen, but I pursued my acting career until I was in my, I guess I was 24 when I kind of dropped out. It had been really tough. It was feast or famine. There were, you know, I would have like, I did an ABC sitcom one year. And that was the closest I had come at that point to having like a steady job.
A regular paycheck.
Paycheck and a place where I had to show up. And oh my God, it was like, you know, daytime work hours, not sort of round the clock crazy on location hours. So, we shot at Sunset and Gower Studios, and I did that for a year, and that was exciting. And then there was like a year and a half long drought where I didn't work a day. But I was busy all the time with auditions and callbacks and preparing for auditions and driving all over. This was when you had to go pick up your sides from your agency, you know, on Sunset Boulevard. I don't even think we had a fax machine back then. Certainly no email. So
when you're taking this year off, you know, or not on purpose, but you have a year of drought.
Yeah.
What are you living on? How are you funding that?
So I was just really frugal and careful with my savings, and I always have been. I was never the kind of actor who would say like, oh, yippee, I just got paid $40,000. I can go out and buy a car. I would say, great, I've got $40,000. That will last me 2 years. Like,
right.
You know, like stretch it to the bone and beyond it. But I was always like, I was never like a materialistic, like label wearing, you know, kind of ostentatious young person. So I just had my own kind of lifestyle.
Well, and where do you think you got that from? Was it a learned behavior from a parent? Did you see something in your home that your parent, one of your parents who imparted that to you, or a teacher, or is it just from being kind of a young professional? I mean, you were actually working when most of us were, I don't know, going to basketball games and being, you know, silly.
My mom was a mature student when I was growing up. So my parents divorced when I was 7. And then I lived with my mother, who was pursuing a master's degree. And so she was a university student. So we lived on no money at all. And times were always really tough. And so I never looked at money as something to take for granted or be wasteful with. So I've just always been really, really, just really like parsimonious with it. Like I'm really careful with it. And I think that that was just my survival, instincts. And also I knew the business well enough to know that, that it was, you could never guarantee consistency. And so I was just really careful. And then, you know, for a while there, I had a boyfriend, I had a partner who I lived with, and sometimes he was working more than me. And sometimes I was working more than him. We bought a house together, bought my first house with him when I was 21.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really cool. So that was just always my attitude. And also I just had a kind of like, oh, it's up to me. So I'm not going to extend myself or get myself into a jam, because there's no you know, safety net or backup plan. My parents didn't have means, and so I was just very self-sufficient.
And I think that's the thing is, you know, when we as parents have children, and we're technically role models, because we are, because kids by osmosis are watching and they're taking in all that's happening. And sometimes, you know, seeing someone like your mom, who is a single mom, you know, kind of putting herself through university, so on and so forth, it was tough, but it was also, I think, really good for you to witness because mm-hmm. you probably are much better with managing your own money than a lot of people who didn't witness something like that, where money was freer and, you know, often given without any question.
Well, that's like the thing. I would look around at my peers and some of them were sort of like, you know, there was just this assumption that if I get into a jam that like something will come, like my parents will come along and save me. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, if I need, you know, I would watch my friends setting up their first homes, for example, and like, oh my, you know, my parents gave me their old car and they bought me all the towels that I need and all the dishes. And I didn't have any of that. So, the idea of just sort of taking for granted this idea that like some unseen force will catch me if I stumble, I just never grew up with that. And I don't know whether, I mean, obviously, there's a shadow side to that too, because it comes with a great deal of, you know, anxiety and a sense of I'm the only one in the universe who's not allowed to have support. You know, everybody else has support. I don't. I'm not allowed to have that. And so I had a little bit of a complex about that for a while, for sure.
Right.
And the other side of it, which is that I think that in some ways, what I'm working to overcome now that I'm a business owner, is it inculcated in me a little bit of a like small thinking, mm-hmm. you know. So, if when you are counting your pennies, mm-hmm. you're very fixated on the pennies,
correct?
And so, you know, the idea of being able to like add a zero or two to everything was just very scary. So, like when I went into business, and was processing like, you know, sending out big invoices and paying big invoices and just like, you know, watching large volumes of money flow through the company, it was scary at first. It's a little bit like, you know, being used to walking at a walking pace and then getting in a fast car on the freeway. It's not inherently, well, it is, that's a bad analogy because of course it is more dangerous, but but just dealing with the numbers, I had to get comfortable with bigger numbers.
Yes.
And that was really a process for me. That was in that time like that I alluded to where I was conscientiously trying to direct my own kind of path and also cultivate a mindset intentionally that was going to serve me to get me there, and getting comfortable with expanding my capacity for dealing with bigger numbers and playing a bigger game.
It is scary because when you're trying to like control your finances or control your money and, you know, you only have a finite amount, which mm-hmm. we all do, but some are smaller than others, it makes you think twice about every single thing you spend money on. Mm-hmm. And that can be very limiting. So, I'd like to explore with you once we get to that point, what was the tipping point where you actually felt comfortable in taking on some risk? Because obviously, you know, I say this in my job as a wealth manager, there's no reward without risk. So we talk a lot about risk-adjusted return. How much reward do you want for how much risk you're willing to take? If you're willing to take a lot of risk and, you know, go with the ups and downs with what that is, you might have an outsized reward over time, but there's going to be a fair amount of risk and a fair amount of volatility. So there's somewhere in between, there's a good amount of, you know, there's the risk adjustment that you can deal with. I'll take this amount of risk to get this kind of reward. But that's a really hard decision to make, especially when you've been living kind of just trying to pay the rent. And, mm-hmm. you know, to think bigger than that is sometimes just too much for people. So I would like to talk about that at some point as we go through this. So, all right. So you're doing the acting jobs because I think it's really important because you obviously enjoy being an actress. Mm-hmm. You wanted to get to the part, you know, everybody wants to be famous and be a famous actress. But then it sounds like in 1996, you're like, okay, I'm out. I'm not going to do this anymore. So what caused you to stop doing this and then move, it sounds like, to the United Kingdom, mm-hmm. to probably London? You know, that's a big move. Like, did you know people there or you just said, that's it, I'm changing my whole life?
Yeah, both. That was me being adventurous. I just felt like I needed some more adventure. Mm-hmm. What happened was that the acting had been a struggle in that last year before I left LA. There wasn't, you know, the jobs weren't really flowing in. And I had an opportunity to move to England. I had a British passport that my father had obtained for me. He was English and English expat. So he said, you know, here's your here's your documents. He gave it to me for my 23rd birthday, I think. Mm-hmm. Like, here's your passport. You can go live in Europe if you want. So I thought, well, that's kind of exciting. Maybe I should do that. And as I was kind of getting my head wrapped around the that plan, I also met, fell in love with, and got pregnant by an Englishman. So
in L.A. or
I was on a movie set. Yeah. So I was living in L.A. at the time.
Fortuitous, I guess.
So that was like, oh, well, this all goes. And again, I'm still at the stage in my life where I'm being blown by the wind. So like, oh, okay, perfect. The universe is telling me I'm supposed to move to London and I'm going to have a baby now. And that's so exciting. And I always wanted that. And how great. And it turned out to be more complicated and tougher than that. But I did move to England. My daughter was born there. And I kind of tried to revive my acting career on that side.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, yeah. Were you going to pursue acting in England now?
Yeah, you know, I thought about it, but I was also getting super disenchanted with it because I knew at that stage, I had some friends that were a little older than me, a little further down the road, been doing it as long or longer. And I saw that it was an incredibly fickle industry.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
doesn't
you,
matter where you are. It's just a fickle industry.
You can have like 5 or 10 great years and then you can be a washed up has been, you know, by your 30s. And it was very difficult to sort of go effort in, results out. Like, mm-hmm. It's just not straightforward.
It's not linear. No.
So I didn't like it for that. And I also didn't like, as a feminist myself and as a, you know, person who was struggling with, like, as we all, pretty much all are, you know, like self-esteem and body issues, I didn't like the fact that acting as a business, like, you are your own commodity. Your business, your body is your business.
Right.
Partly. I mean, yeah. Obviously it's the, you know, the talent and the spirit you bring to your role, but that is packaged in your physical form. And I was disgusted and disheartened by, you know, just the blatant, I used to term body fascism, you know, just like, this is okay, that is not, lose some weight, you know, she should have a bigger boobs, you know, all these like, and I just, I didn't love it. So, so what I decided to do at that stage after my daughter was born was, I got very enchanted by visual arts and I was living near Portobello Road and, so I did a fine art course and I was all set to go and do, a fine art degree.
Where did you do that?
Well, I went to a neighborhood college in North London. I was living, you know, near the Ladbroke Grove, Notting Hill area.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to like a local college and did like a 3-day-a-week pre-foundation course is what it is called.
Because so. I went to Heatherley's.
Oh, okay.
Well, I live in London. I like to oil paint. I'm a bit of a dilettante. So I did a whole course at Heatherley's because I wanted to learn how to oil paint.
I love that.
Really
yeah,
well, which I do. Well, I did. I don't have time now to oil paint, but I will again someday.
Kim, we need to exchange, swap stories about that because I have recently started oil painting again in a really big way. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm painting now. But, but back then I wasn't sure which discipline I wanted to go into and what medium I wanted to work in, but I knew that I was really enchanted. But it was the late 90s, the YBA, the Young British Artist thing was happening, Saatchi and, you know, the all the, you know, Tracy Emin and cool artists coming on the scene. And I was just so enchanted by all that. And I thought that was really liberating and exciting. So
let me ask you a question. You've moved to London. You've had your daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Are you living with the father and who's supporting you and how are you making money?
Yeah, at this point I'm a housewife.
And so are you,
but
you
not married, but yeah.
Not married.
Yeah,
okay. So you've made this decision together and you get there. And if I ask too many personal questions, you can say like,
it's okay. I'm getting better boundaries. I'll be able to say no.
Okay. So you've known this person, I don't know how
5
long.
Seconds.
Okay.
Yeah.
5 seconds. You've gone to London and now this dude's going to support you.
Yeah.
How did you, cause I'm always interested about like, how did you mentally feel about that? Did you feel vulnerable?
Yeah.
Did you feel like you were secure? I mean, you were bringing a child in and you were relying on somebody literally to give you your shelter and your food and all this stuff. So what were you thinking? I mean, were you thinking, I got this, this is all good and this is how it should be. I'm having a kid, he's going to go to work. Or did you feel uncomfortable? Did you feel scared?
Yeah,
all
of those things. On the one hand, I felt like I was living like a charmed life. Like I was so fortunate and I had, you know, we lived in a nice flat in Notting Hill, and he,
which is a very nice area.
Yeah, he was a film director, and I had this baby and all the things needed to raise a baby. You know, I wasn't having to. So on the one hand, I have a really complicated relationship with self-reliance, because as I mentioned, I became self-reliant at a super young age. So the idea of like, this is sanctioned by society. Yes, I'm not earning my own money right mm-hmm. now, but it's okay because I have this baby, and that makes it like permissible.
That's the social contract.
Right, exactly. So I was like, yay, I get to do this now, and I've always dreamed of it, and I'm just going to be...
And like, I can oil paint.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just going to be like a mom and really, really get into that. Unfortunately, it was complicated by all kinds of emotional and relational issues that existed between us, and so it wasn't at all an easy situation, and I didn't feel secure, and I wasn't actually secure. So it was complex. And by the time she turned three, I was out on my own again, and very much out on my own without, you know, resources.
So when you guys made the decision that you were going to move to London, and you know, you have this joyful mm-hmm. event, a child is being born, and that's always a good thing. Did you ever talk about money, or did you just kind of float into how that was all set up?
He was uncomfortable. He had his own issues about money. So,
well, and he is English. Yeah. And the English don't like to talk about money.
And I don't even want to.
Sorry, I'm making a stereotypical comment. But living there, I knew that most people did not ever really like to talk about money head on.
Yeah. And his also, you know, he had family stuff around that too. You know, feelings, you know, not all of what he had was came through his efforts either.
Yes.
So there was like a lot of, you know, and then anyway, I won't even get into like that. But there was definitely, it was not simple. There was lots of tension. And then, as I said, when I, by the time she was three, I was like back on my own feet again, or at least out on my own steam. And so at that time I had to make a decision, like, not to go to art school. I had been accepted into Chelsea College of Art, prestigious,
yeah.
You know, I was so mm-hmm. excited to be an artist, but that wasn't a practical, thing. I, you know, I needed now to make enough money.
And so there was no child support or anything from the father?
Yeah, there was a little bit, but not enough to live on. It wasn't like, oh, this is just going to be my paycheck now. It wasn't.
And you couldn't really go for, I know, I have a feeling in England, if I remember correctly, you can't say that like a domestic relationship is tantamount to a marriage.
Palimony doesn't exist.
Yeah, it doesn't exist there. So.
Yeah. So I was out on my own. And the thing that I chose to do was, you know, again, I was thinking like, what can I do? What can I do to get like 20 pounds? What can I do to get 100 pounds? I wasn't really thinking in an organized way. And again, I go back to, you know, when you ask me like, how did you make this decision to have a baby with this person and move there? Well, that was me going, the universe wants this for me. It's going to be fine. So I was, you know, again, just going by the seat of my pants. But I did have some sewing skills, and I lived right off the Portobello Road. And so I knew friends who had market stalls, and that was a way that I could have an income that was not, you know, that was flexible. And, you know,
so you were making clothing?
Yeah. So then I started off making baby blankets mm-hmm. and, colorful baby blankets. So they were fleecy and had a like a lining on the back, really like the easiest thing you can sew. It's literally a rectangle.
Right.
But I made these baby blankets, and they were pretty nice. And then I moved into some clothing, and I got really enchanted by, like, you know, pattern cutting. And I started making and selling clothes. But
what years were that?
So that would have been, really right around, that was around 2000. That was right around the millennium. Yeah, that was exactly.
So it's so funny because I was living in London then, and had kind of gone off my usual track of being a lawyer and a banker kind of thing, because, you know, my children were they were kind of younger then. They weren't adolescents, but they were about to be adolescents, or one of them was. Mm-hmm. I can't remember, but I had started a fashion company. So when you were doing this, I actually had a store in London on the Fulham Road called Kim Davis London.
Oh,
and I was the designer of the clothes. I'm not a trained designer, but somehow, and it's a convoluted story for another time, I started designing clothes because I was involved with pashminas. But then from there, I started designing clothes, not purposefully so. But one thing led to the other, and I ended up having a fashion company at exactly the same time with pattern cutters and my own. I had a workroom on the Munster Road in Fulham, and then my store was in Chelsea. But then I got fed up with the retail business and decided only to do wholesale. So my collection was sold at Saks Fifth Avenue in the 10 best stores, and this company that I didn't really ever anticipate. But you and I were actually kind of doing same thing in the same city.
Okay, well, you say
the
same
thing,
but your clothes are being sold on at Saks Fifth Avenue. I was literally selling a handmade T-shirt by hand.
No, but the thing is, I started off by selling pashminas, and then I had this crazy idea of what you could do with pashminas, which then led to me talking to some person that I met who worked at Topshop in production, just totally random because she went to my hairdresser. And one thing led to the other. And before I knew it, I had five employees. And I would just FYI, never will I ever do a manufacturing company again because it's super stressful.
It is. Well, and I didn't have employees. I had two industrial sewing machines, a flat sewing machine and a serger in my living room. And that is where I made my product. And in my one, I went at that point, we didn't even have a one bedroom apartment. We lived in my daughter and I lived in just a one room flat. And it was everything. It was her bedroom, my bedroom, our living room, and also my factory.
So when you were doing concluded that as much as I love clothing, and I love clothing, and I always have. And when I graduated from Georgetown before I went to law school, I ultimately decided to go right to law school, but one of the offers I had was to be a buyer at Saks Fifth Avenue in New York City. And this was in 1980. So, the pay was $14,000 a year, and I didn't know anyone in New York. And I was just I don't know how I'm going to live on that. And my father was I'm not helping you. So decide, you can either go to law school. And I thought, I'll go to law school and then I can go buy a lot of clothes.
That's one way to love clothes. Yeah.
That's kind of went the roundabout way on that. But when you were in the midst of this, what was your thinking about how long term you were going to sustain this? How are you going to grow it? Were you thinking about it as an entrepreneur and you're like, okay, I'm going to start with blankets and then I'm going to go on to, I don't know, something else that's kind of related, and then I'll start this product line? What were you thinking? Because, you got this child who's support, you have to support, you got to eat, you got to pay your rent. How were you thinking a Portobello Market stall was going to translate into some sort of cash flow?
Yeah. So first of all, there was a lot of short term thinking there. There was a lot of what can I make this Saturday when the market's on, And so some weekends it would be 300 pounds and I would feel like a rich lady.
Yeah.
And then other times it would be nothing. And
that's kind of like owning a store.
Yeah, exactly.
Some days no one ever comes in.
Yeah. So it was like that. I didn't really have a big plan, but I would say that I kind of felt if I gain traction with my brand and my customers, then some stall holders had opened a little shop in Portobello Green Arcade, which is a little string of boutiques near the market, indoor boutiques. So just sort of taking your stall inside. Mm-hmm. I guess I thought that might happen, but you know what, Kim, I quickly, I don't know how long I did that for, maybe a year. I quickly realized that this was not going to even reliably put food on the table in the short term. So
were you feeling fear then, or what were you feeling?
Yeah, I was, for sure. It's hard to parse out all the different fears. There's the fear of roof overhead fear. And then there's all the just emotional stuff of having been through a really, really harsh relationship and thinking about what am I supposed to be doing with my life and how will I keep myself and my kids safe?
Mm-hmm.
Actually luck and serendipity came along and saved me again. I have to say that the universe really has had my back, whether or not, that's the right way to go through life. That has happened for me. So what happened was, a friend who I had met in an art class, she was, I was complaining to her and saying I'm not making enough regular money and this is just too hard and, too uncertain. And she said, "Oh, Maggie, you're really good with English. You should be an editor. I can teach you how." And so So literally she taught me how.
But more importantly, you were open to the idea.
Yeah.
You might have been a little bit worried about zeros and numbers and things and smaller thinking in that way. But you were kind of open to that idea, which I think is awesome. And that's why I wish more people would be, because sometimes you really do have to pivot, like in a big way.
Yeah, and I think in the meet and the also yeah, so being open to ideas. I mean, no, that was a kind of, like I said, a kind of my hallmark, and for better or for worse.
Oh, actually, this time it was a good one,
highly suggestible. But at the other end, you know, in another part of my kind of brain and survival instinct, I was also starting to get more thoughtful and deliberate about those opportunities and ideas. Also, I should say that while I was having that very difficult, financially difficult patch during the Portobello years, I also did a lot of smart things to kind of live as well as I could with all that financial uncertainty. So, you know, I was a member of a housing co-op and I volunteered to be the treasurer so that I could get a discount on my rent. And I started a babysitting co-op with some friends of mine where, you know, it's like we have like tokens and you share the tokens. It's just a way to get childcare for no money. I was, you know, on the management committee at my daughter's nursery. That wasn't an earning thing, but it was just a kind of like, I was just plugging into the systems and things around me. I was also very good at having a champagne lifestyle and a beer budget. So, you know, living on the market, I would buy vegetables that were about and fruit that was about to spoil, you know, get it for like big box of something for a pound. But then I would also take a pound and buy like a nice little piece of French cheese, you know?
So you can spoil yourself. It doesn't have to be, you know, we all have those moments where we're tight for money, but you can still have some simple pleasures that are nice.
So little luxuries.
But you are pretty entrepreneurial, I think, because you were already kind of negotiating your way through rough waters, but doing things that were, you know, maybe not in dollars and cents, but they were ultimately in dollars and cents, you know, adding to your bottom line.
Yeah, I was trying to develop my skills and abilities to sort of, you know, work. I was trying to, you know, join the mainstream world a little bit and develop some, you know, some skills and resources in that area. So my friend taught me how to edit. She taught me like what it means to be a substantive editor and a copy editor and how to make marks on paper and how to use Quark Express, which was the page layout tool that everybody was using back then. And as luck would have it, she was going on mat leave or she had been a freelancer and she was having a baby. So she said, oh, well, you know, I get calls all the time for work and I can't take them now. I'm going to take time off and have a baby. So I'll just recommend you. So she got me my first freelance gigs. And then lo and behold, I turned out to be really talented in that. So then I quickly, you know, managed to just get hired on my own merit. And that was when I got my first actual job. It was actually my first real job where I had like a company that I worked for and a paycheck. I was 29 years old. And
that must be, I mean, did that feel awesome you feel constrained by that?
It was great. No, I loved it. It was a magazine company. It was super cool. Everybody was like young and fun.
And this was in London.
It was in London. It was really close to my, you know, my daughter's school is around the corner. You know, I was still in Notting Hill. The company was also based there. So I was just like in my neighborhood, in my element. And now I had this cool media job that I just sort of like pushed my way into and turned out to be really good at it. So I was in that company for 2.5 years. And in that time I was elevated. I was promoted to managing editor on this magazine that I was working on.
That's awesome.
Cause I was just, you know what, that was like my work ethic coupled with my innate kind of my talent with the
good with the words is what I'm trying to say.
you're a creative, right?
Yeah.
So you were creative from day one as an actress, but that kind of started to filter in through your life in other ways. And that's the thing is like life is not linear for anybody. Nobody. I don't know anybody with a linear life. So these little things that we don't know where they're taking us, you know, they kind of are like a little tributary. And it, you know, they think you are deep down a creative person with a lot of entrepreneurial spirit.
Yeah.
And as a writer or an editor, you know, that is a creative outlet. You know, you have to be creative to be able to look at that stuff and kind of figure out how to make it palatable to the rest of the world. So you're in London. You are successful. You have a well-paying job. You're a managing editor.
I bought a flat.
You bought...
I mean, that's amazing, right? So you're like in cloud nine.
Yeah.
So.
At that point, I was doing great. And I was feeling really, really good about having picked myself up, you know, off of my knees, like after leaving
my daughter's dad. It's a very big accomplishment.
Dad was really, really tough. Yeah. And then the time came to I wanted to leave the UK and take my daughter back to Canada when she was eight. So that was 2004. And at that time, I had made a bunch of money on the flat that I had bought. You know, it went up 50% in 18 months. I was at the tail end of the big lift. And so there's like, I had this, oh God, Kim, I remember when I picked up the check from the estate agent after I sold that flat, and I had this check in my hand for £62,000. And I was shaking. I felt like I had to quickly get it into the bank, or it would burst into flames, or somebody would take it away from me, or it would, you know, somehow self-destruct, or like I wasn't supposed to have it. Like
right.
It was just this sense of like, it was so much money to me then.
Yeah, you know? Of course. No, you're young and you've been, you know, you've done a lot, and that's a lot of money.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, and
that's still a lot of money.
Yeah, it is. It is. At that stage, it was like a mind-blowing amount, and it was, you know, I made a lot of really, I guess I was always really prudent with my decisions. And so it was a combination of, and you talked earlier about taking risks versus making calculated decisions. And I have always been a fan of blending both of those things. So most of my risk taking, including buying the flat in London, when, you know, like when it was,
which is always a risk.
Yeah. And at that time it was the height of the market. But I looked at it and I ran the numbers and I was like, okay, well, you know, this is what my mortgage payment's going to be. This is what my income is. This is not really, it feels scary. So separating the emotional component of risk taking, which is just like, this is uncertain, this is new, from the risk, which is like a logical risk. So on paper, it wasn't really risky at all.
Right.
And when I could see that, that helped me to get over the emotional, like the jitters and the nerves. And I wanted to also say something else about risk, which is that when I was younger in particular, the feeling of, I was always better at taking bolder risks and making bolder moves in my life when my back was against the wall. It was a real sort of do or die survival instinct. And that's not that served me well, but it's not the place that I want to be making my life decisions from now. I don't do that anymore. And so I underwent like a really deliberate process of trying to reorient my mindset so that I wasn't, because what happens when you only do your greatest, you know, your best things out of a sense of like, you know, fear of annihilation, you know, what happens if that's where you find your strength and your, you know, your greatest ability to act and have agency in your life, then what happens is you subconsciously keep on putting yourself back in peril just because that's your power place. Or
I think you bring up some, there's a lot of things that I can start talking about off of these. So first of all, people talk a lot about women being risk averse. So they say women don't like to take risks. And especially when we talk about money, you know, they say, you know, women don't like to invest because they're risk averse. They don't want to take any risk and they want to put all their money in cash. That's not actually totally true, although they do have a proclivity to want to hold cash. And I think they're more risk aware.
Mm-hmm.
But I think to your point about fear is if you have knowledge and like what you said is you sat down, you did your numbers, and then you had the knowledge that it actually looked right on paper.
Mm-hmm.
You could handle it. It made sense for a lot of reasons. But you had logically sat down calmly and figured it out. And I think when women I talk to want to, for example, in the investment world, just want to hold cash because they're afraid of taking any risk and volatility, it's like, well, you don't really have a loss unless you're selling that position on any given day. And if you are in a solid investment, and you've done your homework and you're a long-term investor, if you don't do it, you will run out of money if you just rely on cash for the rest of your life. And that's maybe you're operating from fear because you just want to see that money in your bank account. But what you don't realize is over 5 or 10 years, that $100,000 that you have today is worth like 50. In 10 years, it still looks like $100,000, but it can only buy you $50,000 worth of stuff.
And so when you sit down and you kind of analyze that numerically and you talk about it, then your fear should subside because you're like, okay, right, that makes sense because I'm actually putting myself in a bad position.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really important what you said was that you made that decision to buy the flat. That's always scary to put but you did get an asset for it.
Yeah.
And you figured out that you could sustain the cash flow from what you were making and pay your mortgage and so on and so forth. And that would eliminate the fear because you were just being rational.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, so my company, we published a book by a female financial advisor a few years. It was right at the beginning, right after we launched. And one of the things that's really stuck out from her book was the insight that apparently, so women and men, risk aversion, right? Apparently, when, as you said, when women have more knowledge, we have much greater appetite for risk. She pointed to some study which really blew my mind, which apparently when men they're the most confident and most most comfortable with risk when they know less. The more that men learn, the more risk averse they become. They would rather blaze forward with their eyes closed, and they're more comfortable taking a big leap of faith, doing it that way. But women don't like to do that. We like to know exactly what we're getting into, and then we're equally confident or even more so.
They definitely punt. I mean, I read a study recently where, and this is kind of a similar idea, the HP wanted more women to get involved in certain positions that were, you know, kind of, I'll call them STEM oriented, you know, engineering, math, computer type
science,
things,
technology.
Exactly. So they found that what they discovered was these qualified women that they thought were qualified for these jobs, who they reached out to, were reluctant to apply because they were not willing to apply unless they felt they were 100% qualified for those jobs. Men would apply for those jobs when they were only 50 to 60% qualified, and they felt perfectly confident in doing that. And so that's the thing with women. Like, they want it all nicely wrapped up in a bow, and because we've been trained to be perfectionists and to strive for that.
Well, and this is also getting back to like what I was talking about earlier with my upbringing and not having a safety net. I think that I didn't have the luxury of waiting for life to be safe before I moved forward.
Right.
And so, you know, just like a man who might go, I'm going to take a chance on myself. I really did that as a teenager. I did that as a 20 something. I did that in my 30s where I'm just going like, F it, you know,
yeah.
That's the only way
you grow. I mean,
exactly. And I'm so, so, so glad I did. So I am happy investing in myself, trusting myself, taking a chance and learning on the job. I've done that a lot.
And learning on the job is really the way for a lot of people to pivot or start a side hustle, whatever. But I'm not saying people should be irresponsible and just, you know, don't worry about risk and just take all kinds of chances. Obviously, you know, that would go against everything advice I would give to anybody. But I also think for women with respect to their own confidence, too, they expect perfection from themselves. Mm-hmm. So they don't have the full confidence unless they've ticked all the boxes. And that's just not realistic. So I always say good is good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And just be good. Be qualified. Look at all the things. Try to better yourself. Try to do things on the side or educate yourself. But definitely take some chances, because if you don't, you're just not going to move ahead.
Yeah, you can't grow in that zone. It's the difference between risk-taking and recklessness.
Correct. That's very good.
I don't want to be reckless. I'm never going to be reckless, but I am going to stretch myself beyond, just a bit beyond what I think I'm, you know, really confidently able to do. And then I become more, and now I have done that enough times that I know that when I'm outside my comfort zone in that way, that it's just a question of expansion. I just have to expand and grow and learn a few more things. And that has been the way that it works. So after I left London, I took my daughter back to Vancouver, and that's when I went to work at the newspaper there,
mm-hmm.
the Vancouver Sun, and I started as a sort of like a filler in on the news desk as a copy editor, and worked across a bunch of departments wherever they needed me. And then eventually, after a couple of years, I was promoted to the head of the arts and life department. So then I became basically the features editor for the paper. And that was really exciting for me because I was covering arts and entertainment and food
like
and fashion and all the things, you know, all the things that I really, really, really like get excited about, not, you know, sort of city hall and municipal politics. I know that lots of reporters are really super excited about that, but I loved, you know, the features. And so it was kind of my dream job, but also my dream job at the worst possible time for, well, the worst possible time at that point in history. It's probably worse now, but, you know, just for journalism as an industry.
As a paper.
Yeah, it was tough.
A physical paper.
Mm-hmm. Or even just as a digital first newsroom, which, you know, we became. But it was hard and demoralizing. We had like wave after wave of staff reductions. I lost... You know, I think when I started as the Arts and Life editor, I had a combination of the in-house reporters and also my regular freelancers had about 20 people filing into my sections. And by the time I left, 5 years later, I was down to just three.
Yeah.
So, like, you couldn't really do a newspaper that you're, or, you know, a weekend section or whatever that you're super proud of. So the paper was offering rounds of buyouts. And they went through a couple of those while I was there, voluntary staff reductions and paying people, you know, to leave their jobs. And this was a unionized newsroom, so really a lot of people who thought that they were going to be there for life,
right?
And then after like the third round of it, I just thought like, wow, well, I've been here long enough now that I qualify for the maximum, which equated to about a year's worth of salary. And I was like, yep, I'm out of here. I'm going to put my hand up and go for the buyout and take this money and, you know, take this, this opportunity to start something of my own. And that's when I founded my publishing company, which was then called Life Tree Media. And we were founded in 2013. And I started, you know, just working out of my house. And
so what did publishing. That look like? You had a you made yourself into a corporation.
Mm-hmm.
It was just you or you and a friend or you and a colleague. What did it look like?
Well, I incorporated right off the bat. And our workforce initially was, yeah, I was doing a lot of the kind of the conceptual work and obviously just the building of the business infrastructure. And I was really determined to take it a lot more sort of seriously than I had taken my market stall. And having been in a managerial position at the newsroom for the last 5 years, I knew how to manage people. I knew how to manage projects, but more importantly, I knew how to manage people. And I had a great database of freelance, you know, editors and designers that I knew. So I knew that I could make books and I knew that I could run a project, you know, to get, mm-hmm. see that book to production and beyond. I formed a business relationship with a local publishing company, that had distribution and was willing to allow to put my books into their pipeline. So mm-hmm. under my own imprint, but that was how I gained access to distribution right away. I built the company on the hybrid publishing model for the reason that so what that means is
So the first thing I want to understand is, so you had your year's worth of salary, which presumably whatever else you had saved, you're living on that right at that point.
Yeah.
Did you have to make an investment into this company? How much, you know, did you do a business plan?
Mm-hmm.
Did you know how much you needed to invest in it? Did you do like cash flow projections as to what you thought, how many books you needed to publish to make yourself you make the whole effort worthwhile?
So sort of. I didn't really know a lot about cash flow forecasting or a business plan. I knew a little bit about it, but not, I didn't have a great plan in mm-hmm. mind. I did it in a very kind of what was a manageable way for me at the time, which was it was just me and it was freelancers. And because on the hybrid book publishing model is that we're basically a service business. So mm-hmm. it's a fee for service with authors. So I basically didn't spend any money until I had a contract signed. And then it was all just costs of goods sold. So it was all just like these are the expenses. And I knew that I was... my fees were
well, I mean, adequate to cover expenses.
Yeah, I mean, you had to pay the subcontractors, but you also had to pay yourself. And
that part I didn't really do. So in the first year, what I did was I took my money from the Vancouver Sun. I put it in a savings account. And then every 2 weeks on exactly the same schedule that I had been getting a paycheck on, I transferred that exact same amount of money over to my current
account. Yeah.
So I just kept myself on salary and just spent my money down like that. And so I didn't take any, salary from the business for the first year. And then after a short while after that, I had an employee and I'd still, you know, we still rely heavily on subcontractors because they're just so flexible. But
so who was your first customer? And how did you get them?
Yeah. So word of mouth. And actually my very first customer was a guy named Joe Kelly, and he was just doing concept development at that point, which is just like you went through it with us too, right? Just sit down and like hammer out how is this book going to be organized and outlined.
What's it going to look like?
Yeah. And then very quickly I went on to do, actually it was the female, financial advisor, Tracy Themes is her name. And she had me edit her book. And then I said, well, Tracy, she had already self-published it, but I said, you know, we can publish this to the trade and put it under.
So what's the difference between for those? Because for me, I was like, yeah, I want to write a book. And then that's as much as I know about writing a book was that I wanted to write one. So what's the difference between self-publishing, hybrid publishing, and regular publishing?
Okay, so I've gotten really good at breaking this down. I hope I can keep it. There's a lot of confusion about it. So traditional publishing is the way that it always was, right? When what the traditional publisher does is they are in the business of developing books as a product, and then they sell that product. Where do they get the books from? They get them from authors. And so essentially what they're doing is they're licensing the right to turn your material that's in your head or, you know, will eventually be on a computer file, but that raw material to productize it and turn it into a book that then is their product that they will then go and sell. And in exchange for your contribution to that, they pay you what is essentially a licensing fee, but in the form of a royalty.
Right.
So that's the traditional.
So you get money up front-ish.
You get, well, if you get an advance. The advance is it's an early payment against future royalties is what the advance is. But they're basically, you know, buying the right to take your intellectual property and turn it into a product that they then own. So that is the traditional paradigm. Also important to note, part of the publisher's really kind of core defining activities are, yes, the development of the work into a book, but also taking it to market. So the traditional publisher,
marketing,
they either have it in house or they work with a third party distributor, but they have the access to the book trade, which is what we call, you know, where books are sold in retail setting. So that's the traditional publisher's kind of like universe of activities. Then came self-publishing, which took away the need to be in stores by, you know.
And when did that pop up?
Well, I don't know. It was like kind of early 2000s. It was like when Amazon was sort of beginning its thing. And then I don't really know when self-publishing became. I mean, it was breaking open around 2010
Was it maybe related to the fact that people weren't going to traditional bookstores
anymore? No, it wasn't that. It wasn't because of a lack of interest in that. It was literally because digital platforms allowed people to. It was print-on-demand technology and ebooks that made it happen.
Right.
Before you had to go and buy a book that someone had printed and shipped to a store. But with these digital delivery systems, consumers are able to buy, you know, a book that is directly, that's never been printed. So print on demand means, you know, if I go to Amazon and or somewhere else and buy a book that, you know, it hasn't been printed, it's not sitting in a warehouse, it's just a digital
file.
You
just download it. And
well, you basically, you know, you hit purchase, I want a physical copy of it. That goes to the print on demand facility. And it's almost like printing out a document at your home printer, but what you're printing out is a book, and then they ship it to you.
Okay.
Straight from the...
That's efficient.
So it's literally printed on demand. So when print on demand and ebook technology was on the rise and Amazon found a way to make those services available directly to authors, that was the beginning of self-publishing. So a lot of people were interested in doing that. What that means then, if you're self-publishing your book, you have to make all of the decisions that the publisher would normally make. Now, can you make them to the same professionalism? You know, probably not, unless you come from that, you know, unless that's your practice. You have to finance it. So if you are going to get an editor or a designer or anyone to help you, you are the producer of that work. Basically, you're the investor. And that also means that you will get, you know, you're the one who gets paid when it is sold. So that is self-publishing. But then there's this gap in between, is people were like, okay, I like the power and control of the self-publishing thing. I want to have all that, those, you know, keep the sales myself. I want to be able to say when it happens and be in control of the, you know, the process and all that. I don't want to have to wait for a traditional publisher to choose me. So I like self-publishing, but I want my book to be a real book. I want it to be well professionally developed, and I want it to be available in stores because I have a serious aspiration as an author. So I don't want to be sort of sidelined in this kind of like, you know, this sort of like I want to be in the A game, right? I'm in the main game. So enter hybrid publishing, and that's basically what my company does, which is we make books on a fee-for-service basis, and then we put them into the market. Our authors are the financiers of those books, and they also make more of the money from sales.
So let me ask you a question, because you said in the hybrid that the author is putting money into it just like in the self-publishing venue. Is there a cost differential? Do you spend more self-publishing than you do hybrid publishing, or do you spend more hybrid publishing?
Yeah, so
it's not kind of a false question, I understand, because it's when you're self-publishing, you're not getting any guidance. So in hybrid publishing, and I know from my experience with you, you know, like you're helping me to look at things in a way that if I was just off on my own doing this, I probably, it wouldn't be as nuanced, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, well, it would be an amateur effort, even if it was a very well executed amateur effort. You know, you're not a book publishing professional, and most authors are not. So, you know, we work with really excellent people, and so the short answer to your question is hybrid publishing is usually more expensive than traditional than self publishing. But if you look at even self publishing, there's a really wide range. So if you think about like, there's DIY self-publishing, which is just super scrappy, and it's like, I'm going to invest $0 and do everything myself. And that is possible. You can literally self-publish a book for no money at all.
And so if you do that...
But it's going to look like that.
But can you put that book... Can a person who self-publishes put that book on Amazon? Or
Yeah. Amazon is full of terrible books. I mean, it really, really is. Like, the self-publishing universe is really, really, because there's literally no quality control, and like there's nothing. Yeah. So anybody can publish anything. You can literally just, you know, type gibberish into a document and upload
it on Amazon and pick a price for it. Yeah. And hope for the best.
Yeah. Nobody's going to buy it. You know, it's not going to do anything, but that space is extremely cluttered with amateur, you know, things that not even really necessarily in every case call them books, you know, but documents that people have uploaded. And you see some terrible, like laughable covers and, you know,
Who does the artwork, and, you know, and they look more like pamphlets.
Yeah. But on the other hand, there are companies that will do assisted self-publishing, and our company also offers that as one of our programs. And that is for someone who doesn't want to go into retail stores. They don't want to do a print run distribution. They just want to, you know, have their book on Amazon or in digital format. But they want it to be professionally produced. And there are lots of companies that have sprung up to help people do that too. That's also not cheap. And, you know, as with any professional service, there's just this huge, you know, kind of range of quality providers and a huge range of costs and fees associated. So you can find somebody, you know, it's a kind of wild westy out there right now. Like you can find a designer on Fiverr to do your cover for $150. It's going to look like $150.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You know, we work strictly with professionals, and all of the designers and editors on our team have built their careers in the traditional publishing industry. So they're really, and the reason that makes a difference, it's not just sort of legacy kind of halo effect, although that's kind of probably part of it. You know, they've been
they've spent their time developing their craft in a professional environment and not just like serving clients who don't know good from bad, you know, that's so different. But the other reason that it matters is because if we're doing print run distribution, if we're printing a quantity of books and putting them out to stores, you need to be aware of consumer appetites. You need to be aware of trends. You need to be aware of like what the market expects from that book in order to be competitive. You can't just sort of say, well, I'm happy with it. Just stick it out there.
So in your group, in your company, you kind of are also doing market research, mm-hmm. I would say, right? So you know, like, for example, with my book, where is it going to fit into the market? Who's going to buy the book?
Positioning. Yeah, exactly. How is this book positioned? How is it different from the other ones on the shelf? Why would any consumer, what would move a consumer to pick this title up instead of the other ones that are already available in that space? And, you know, in your case, you know, it has to do with your personality. It has to do with, you know, there's a modernity to your approach and to your voice. You know, we've had conversations about, you know, other books about finance for women that and how this one will be different. So it's very much about kind of like finding a lot of what we do is like finding what is like that sweet spot between, okay, here's what is unique and different about this human, about this person and the things that they know, but also what is sort of missing, what have not we seen in the
and
market.
And so when you're self-publishing, you can't really do that because you're just busy writing a book and then you print it out and that's the end of it.
Yeah. And people, they, you know, like some folks do a really great job self-publishing and really honestly, most don't because they just don't, you know, they're not coming at it from a professional a body of knowledge and, you know, they're writing or making decisions that seem good to them. But that's not the same thing as developing a product for market.
What part of the, so if you could break up the market between traditional publishing, self-publishing and hybrid publishing, like what percentage of the market is hybrid publishing right now?
Really?
Because it's a kind of new concept.
Yeah,
it's, I think.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's a sliver. It's a really small sliver right now. And that is, I think, because it's an emerging niche in terms of the business model. And frankly, it's difficult to set up as a hybrid publisher because one of the key defining features, one of the key defining features is that you must have distribution into stores, and that is hard to get when you are brand new and don't have a track record. I was going to say I'm on the board of directors at the Independent Book Publishers Association and on their advocacy committee. And a couple of years ago, I was part of the group on the advocacy committee that drafted a set of criteria for bona fide hybrid publishers, trying to get the industry on the same page in terms of like, what does this mean and who is and isn't a hybrid publisher. There are some firms out there that describe themselves that way, but in fact, they don't have distribution. So really all they're doing is developing your book and putting it on Amazon, which, you know, they're not adding.
You can do that yourself.
Yeah, you can do it yourself. They're not adding value in terms of like market access or even, you know, again, that being competitive with other titles that are traditionally published and put into stores.
So when a hybrid book goes into a traditional bookstore, say like Barnes & Noble or whatever, and how do they fare compared to traditionally published books? And I don't know if you know the answer to that, but it's kind of interesting to me.
It's a level playing field, I think. So
the consumer doesn't really know. They just see a book,
of course, yeah. So what matters there is how well the author is getting the word out there to their own audience and like how, what are you doing to, I mean, this is where social media comes in and all of the, you know, the podcasting, all the stuff that you've been doing to kind of build awareness of yourself and your thought leadership and your expertise. Those are the things that make a difference because people want to go, you know, if they, you, there are two levels to selling a book. The first level is to sell it to the retailer and persuade that retailer to stock it. The second level is that it has to sell through to the customer. And so creating consumer awareness and customer demand is really largely in today's media climate, it's really driven by the author. And that is true even if it, you know, a traditional publisher, Penguin Random House, is there, you know, a publisher or whatever, it comes down to the author, their platform, their ability to attract a tribe and connect with that tribe and to have people know and expect their book. That is what drives book sales in every market now. So it really, I mean, and to have a traditionally published book doesn't necessarily mean it's going to sell well. There are lots and lots and lots of them that tank every single year. The difference is that you're in the store, you're in the trade, your sales are counted by those.
But do they not have a budget like to promote the author?
Mm-hmm. Depends these days. Yeah. So, traditional publishers are getting much more risk averse in terms of what they will invest in. And so, yeah, they'll have like a huge marketing budget for their stars. And then most newcomers, especially if you can get a deal at all, the author's expected usually to, you know, foot the bill and do their mm-hmm. own marketing, or sometimes there might be like a press release or a limited, you know, kind of a campaign around it. But the hustle is always going to come back to the author.
There seems to be so many people that write books now. Like every mm-hmm. time I turn around or I go on Amazon or I'm just looking around, just everybody seems to have written a book.
Mm-hmm.
So for a minute there, I was like, well, should I even write a book? Because like everyone says, well, I've written a book. But then mm-hmm. I thought, no, I really want to write a book because I have things I think are meaningful to say and share with women about how they can, you know, become financially in control of their futures. And hopefully it'll be a philosophical / handbook toolbook kind of thing for them, toolbox for them to follow.
Yeah, like more people are writing books than ever before.
Books are a dime a dozen.
Well, they are. It's a very, very, very crowded space. It's hard to kind of like stand out from the pack, but especially in the self-published world where, like I said, there's just like something like 200,000 books a year are self-published.
Unbelievable.
It's kind of ridiculous, but you know what, Kim? People are still reading books.
Which is great.
They're reading books more than ever, you know? That is still very active, very, very much happening, especially, you know, with new formats like audiobooks. I'm a recent convert to audiobooks. I love them. And I think our definition of what a book is breaking down, you know, a little bit. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily have to be bound on paper and bought in a store. But what, you know, we need to learn from each other. And books are the best way that I know to transfer knowledge and wisdom or inspiration from one person's head to another's. Maybe that's just, you know, my milieu. It's the world I come from and how I think and feel. But I know that in my life, everything, especially as this kind of a self-taught person who kind of didn't really go through traditional educational routes, books have been there for me every step along the way. When I needed to learn something, or I was grappling with an emotional issue, or, you know, some, whether it's internal, external, practical, or spiritual, anything, it comes from a book. You know, that's really where I have turned to for sources of wisdom and information since forever. And that hasn't changed. People are still, you know, wanting to have a deeper understanding right. than you can get in a blog post. Yeah. Like, yeah, we're looking at YouTube videos yeah. and we're reading blog posts. But when you sit down with a book,
those are sound bites.
Yeah, with a book is like an 8 to 15 hour investment to read a book. You know, it will take that much of your time to read that book, or, you know, longer. Sometimes it'll be spread out over months or even longer. But you're really getting a deeper piece of that author's yeah. brain than
and
you could get
experience,
in a different format.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I love to read. I've always been a voracious reader. And I, you know, it's also when I'm trying to distract myself, you know, if I'm reading a really good book, I can reopen the book and, you know, kind of think about the book for a while, and it takes my mind off my problems.
Yeah.
Instead of watching a television show. You know, I think the richness of language is still a beautiful thing, mm-hmm. and it may be getting, you know, lost as time goes on. I don't know. But I do think the richness of language is important. So let me ask you a question. You relaunched your company recently from Life Tree Media to Wonderwell.
Mm-hmm.
So why did you do that? What was the motivation for that?
Yeah, a couple of things. On the one hand, I love the name Life Tree. You know, it really speaks to this sort of ongoing cycle of life, which I, you know, kind of equate with that, the fruits of wisdom that mm-hmm. are passed on and, you know, kind of eternal and self-generating, self-propagating. But what I wanted was a brand that felt kind of grander and more expansive, and taking us a little bit out of maybe the lifestyle and just out of the lifestyle space into some, you know, bigger ideas. So we rebranded as Wonderwell. There were some reasons to do with my, you know, leaving Canada and coming down to the U.S. I've left Vancouver and I'm now in Los Angeles full time. So I literally had to set up a new corporation in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And then looking at trademark and all of that. So there were a bunch of other administrative and legal reasons for doing it. But really, Wonderwell, our tagline is big ideas for a better world. And that's what we're going forward with. That's what we're about.
And did you get any kind of counsel on that? Or was this something you just popped out of your own head?
Yeah, no, I'm done with popping things out of my own head. Mm-hmm. Unexamined. I now know how to find good advisors and collaborators. And so, yeah, I worked with an awesome woman named Michelle Heath. She has a company called Growth Street, and she is basically a fractional CMO. So she worked with me on sort of developing the brand and the brand promise. And I was done kind of making things in my living room all alone.
Well, that's it. And you need someone, and because there's a whole psychology to these names, mm-hmm. Apparently. So, I think we're coming up on time, but I did want to ask you just to kind of, sum up, because we didn't really touch upon you as a single mother and how that affected your trajectory, the responsibility of raising a child by yourself while you were trying to do all this other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Just in a few words, and I know it's a pretty big question to ask you to answer in a few words, how did that work?
I think that it put steel in my backbone in a way that I don't know that I would have cultivated to the same degree if it was just me,
yeah,
just sort of floating along through life. But I had this child that I had to not only provide for, but also create, a home and
family.
An emotional home for. Yeah. And I could not fail. Failure was just not an option. I could not have a chaotic and I couldn't have a chaotic life. I couldn't. She really also, having a person rely on you means that, yeah, she forced me to think bigger and take those bigger risks. So I think in all those, and also just gave structure to my life.
Being a
creative person and a young mom, I could easily have been, a kind of a sleep all day type of person,
of
or even fighting against, all those things. But, when you've got to get your child up and take her to nursery and you've got to have dinner on the table, so providing structure for her also caused me to provide structure for myself at a very unstable time. And that was empowering.
And does she have any thoughts on your trajectory?
Oh, Kim, I'm her hero.
You're a good role model, right?
I don't want to paint myself as some kind of amazing mother, because I certainly made all the
mistakes. Well, it sounds like you were pretty good mother indeed. You handled a lot.
I was trying, I'm actually sensing her rolling my eyes when I talk about, I don't want to have a chaotic life, because our life was pretty chaotic, and she would be the first to say that. But I have shown her, I think, actually, I just saw her last week. She just went back to England, two days before.
So she's still living in England.
She went to university there, and now she still lives there. She's now 24. But we talked about this when she was out here for Thanksgiving. And I know that I think that I taught her courage. And I think that I'm still a resource for her, for sure. And am always trying to help her cultivate and develop and find and build her own pathways to resources and inner resources. So she's impressed with my scrappiness, but she's certainly not impressed with all of me.
That's just part of being a mom, right? You're not going to get the whole trifecta. It just doesn't work, So I'm just happy my kids think moderately positive thoughts about me.
Exactly.
And that also can vacillate from moment to moment. But it has been an absolute pleasure speaking to you today. I think if people are interested about the publishing world, they mm-hmm. learn some information, and also about the ongoing conversation we have here at the Fiscal Feminist about navigating through life, making changes, not living from a place of fear, but being informed and taking risks in an informed way, having some faith, believing in yourself, having confidence, not expecting to be perfect. Nobody's perfect. We all have to make mistakes. We learn more from our mistakes than we do from sometimes our successes. And I just think it's been a pleasure to hear your story because it really is very interesting. I mean, just, you know, the fact that you were even an actress and a child actress and in movies and things, and then realized that wasn't, you know, going to be the life path. That must have been, you know, kind of scary, disappointing, and interesting as to what you should do next. So what a great, rich life, a tapestry indeed. So, Maggie, thank you again for joining us. And if anybody has any questions about, you know, publishing or whatever, you guys can reach out to me and I can give you kim@thefiscalfeminist.com because I know a lot of people might be interested in writing a book, just like I am. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. Please like us on your podcast service. I'm never exactly sure how you do that, but I know you guys probably know how to do that. And I look forward to the next time. Bye.
The Boxing Group is registered with Hightower Securities, LLC, member FINRA and SIPC, and with Hightower Advisors, LLC, a registered investment advisor with the SEC. Securities are offered through Hightower Securities, LLC. Advisory services are offered through Hightower Advisors, LLC. This is not an offer to buy or sell securities. No investment process is free of risk, and there is no guarantee that the investment process or the investment opportunities referenced herein will be profitable. Past performance is not indicative of current or future performance and is not a guarantee. The investment opportunities referenced herein may not be suitable for all investors. All data and information referenced herein are from sources believed to be reliable. Any opinions, news, research, analysis, prices, or other information contained in this research is provided as general market commentary. It does not constitute investment advice. The team and Hightower shall not in any way be liable for claims and make no expressed or implied representations or warranties as to the accuracy or completeness of the data and other information, or for statements or errors contained in or omissions from the obtained data and information referenced herein. The data and information are provided as of the date referenced. Such data and information are subject to change without notice. This podcast was created for informational purposes only. The opinions expressed are solely those of the team and do not represent those of Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Hightower Advisors do not provide tax or legal advice. This material was not intended or written to be used or presented to any entity as tax advice or tax information. Tax laws vary based on the client's individual circumstances and can change at any time without notice. Clients are urged to consult their tax or legal advisor before establishing a retirement plan.